One of the truly remarkable characteristics of Swami Kriyananda, whom I've known for so many years, the founder of Ananda, the direct disciple of Yogananda, who has inspired all that you're experiencing here, I'm explaining for those who are less familiar with Ananda, has been and is his extraordinary patience and lack of compelling inner need to force a truth on anyone. Very often in our anxiety to ease the sufferings of others, or more accurately often our anxiety to have them behave in a way that we prefer to have them behave so we don't have to endure the consequences of their wrong behavior, there's an inability to hold our tongues at times when we ought to. And the thought that somehow if I just say it to this person with enough force or clearly enough, then they'll of course see things true as I see them, you know, which is a synonymous word a lot of the time. The truth is reality as I perceive it. The characteristic of Swami Kriyananda, and I've seen him interacting in so many circumstances, including the way, and I can only use the words, he has handled me all of these years, is with this complete impersonal desire only for that which will be helpful to the one in front of him, whether it's me or whoever it is. And this willingness to endure whatever is required to endure personally, not to be premature in the presentation of that. I mean, how often is it that somebody will say things to us and we're just, I mean, the words are so obvious, we're not ready to hear them. And no matter how emphatically or clearly it's stated, it just isn't understood. I know a friend of mine once made a very poor decision in her personal life, and it was so self-evident that it was going to be a poor decision. And in the name of friendship, I explained it to her in advance why it would be a poor decision. She ignored me. Years later, when it proved to be exactly as predicted, she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" I explained to her exactly when and how I had told her, and she absolutely swore it had never happened. I was with a friend once when Swami Kriyananda was counseling him, and this particular man had a great many talents, but business was not one of them. And he had this plan for this business, and he really wanted to do this business, and Swami Kriyananda, just as clear as you could say it, said, "You know, it's not necessary for your spiritual development for you to develop talent in this field. You know, you're very good at teaching and in this way and this way. You don't have to also become a businessman." But the man went out and started his business and went bankrupt and caused him all kinds of problems. It went on for years. And later, after it all blew up in his face, I said, "Well, Swami, you know, you don't have to worry about this because spiritually it's not necessary for you to learn this. What makes you say that?" "Well, because Swami Kriyananda said it to you in plain English." No memory. It's like the words just went in and went out. I'm talking about Swami being so adept, and I'm giving you examples now when nobody listened. But the point being that we don't really learn, I have to honestly say, we don't really learn anything from anyone. What happens is when our own level of consciousness has reached a certain degree of understanding, then when it's articulated, we recognize it. And prior to that, if there's no resonant inner vibration, it doesn't matter how clearly it's said, it just passes right through. Now, sometimes there is value in articulating something that will only be remembered, but not understood in the time. You know, often masters, in fact, will do that. They'll plant seeds that much, much later will understand. Swami Kriyananda, as a very young monk, when he first started editing master's writings, at a time when for him to edit was literally a joke because he just didn't know anything about what he was doing, master gave him the instruction, "Work like lightning, but don't change a word." And Swami writes about that in the past, and he just sort of, as a young monk with a task that was so far beyond him anyway, master was planting seeds for the future, he would contemplate, how can you edit without changing a word? Work like lightning, but don't change a word? Well, now, 60 years later, almost, Swami had the inspiration to edit the book Whispers from Eternity. And he did very massive editing on it. I mean, when you read the original and then you read what Swami's about to publish, you'll see that many words are different. But Swamiji did that whole book in 15 days, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. He worked like lightning. But he also began to understand, he was commenting about this later, that lightning strikes from above in a sudden burst of illumination, doesn't it? And we can either work in a sort of steady, plodding manner, just definitely trying to make things happen and reasoning everything out, or we can work in these lightning bursts of divine illumination. And of course, not changing a word, after all these years of editing, Swami has come to deeply understand that what Master meant is don't change a single concept. Don't change any of the meaning and intention of what I said. The actual words that clothe them are not the definition of it, it's the intention behind it. And Swamiji not only edited that entire book, but he had both Nirmala and Dharmadas go over the 1929 and the 1949 edition of that book and compare everything that Swamiji had done to make sure that he hadn't inadvertently shifted any of the concepts. And Dharmadas found one. I mean, there were small things that he altered, but he found one serious one where Swamiji had used the word spurn when the actual meaning was only that the devotee hesitates. And Swami had actually said the devotee spurns this potential. And Dharmadas, pointed out this is not some, it took him a minute to sort of understand, but then he shifted it. You have to work like lightning, but you have to be in tune with what's behind it. Now, in a book I was reading about Rajasi Janakananda, who was one of Master's foremost disciples, there were letters in there from Paramhansa Yogananda to Rajasi. And he recommended to Rajasi a practice. He said, commune with the presence of saints, and then he named the gurus of our lineage, including himself. He just referred to Yogananda as if it wasn't himself. And he says, inwardly, try to feel what the quality of that saint's consciousness might be. And he described himself as joy, among other, joyous perception and wisdom. And Sri Yukteswar as calm, dispassionate observation of life, like this. He said, visualize as clearly as you can what that saint's consciousness is. And then in your heart, absorb that consciousness. He said, do that every day until your consciousness merges with that great soul's consciousness. Now, recently we've had a lot of opportunity because Swami Kriyananda has been here and at the village and all these different places. And I've been listening to him say exactly the same things, almost in exactly the same words, since I first met him in 1969. I consider myself neither a dog or a swine. I've been receiving these pearls and he's been kind enough to cast them in front of me. But it's been astonishing to me, always has been, and somehow more poignantly this summer, how we can only understand what we can understand. And exactly the same ideas, there just comes a certain point where all of a sudden they resonate in a completely different way. One of the thoughts that Swamiji has often said, and all the masters say it, are these words, it doesn't matter what other people think as long as you are right in your heart with the Guru and God. That nothing else matters. That if Guru is pleased, then the whole world can stand against you. And if the whole world praises you, but Guru is not pleased, then there's no happiness inside. Now, I've heard him say that so many times. In these last few weeks, I was somehow, perhaps because we were living so much in his company and there was so much uplifted energy. And he was talking in some context, perhaps in Los Angeles, just about the nature of the breath. He was urging people toward this being more impersonal toward the facts of life. And the obvious question is how. And he started describing what I've heard him describe so many times about one of the most wonderful things about the way Swamiji teaches is that he always builds bridges from even very far out ideas to our actual experience. Now, one of the fundamental principles of yoga is about the flow of the kundalini energy up and down the spine. And all of meditation practice, specifically Kriya Yoga, which we particularly practice here, is about raising the energy up and down the spine and internalizing it. Now, maybe you've had an experience where you've been able to see beyond the physical into that reality, but think of it, and Swamiji always says it just like this. Whenever anything inspires us, We always inhale and our energy, our physical body literally goes up. You see it in children. Oh, we're going to go to the zoo today. And children start sort of starting to levitate. Whoa. And they try to levitate. They try to just get up as high as they can get just to show how excited they are. And children, again, by exaggeration, when things go really terrible, they often literally hurl themselves onto the floor, don't they? They just, you know, they can't bear it anymore, and they'll just fall down like that. And, you know, when children are being tragic, that's what they'll always do. And then there's always that thing where the mother has to pick the limp child up by the arm and drag them, and they're, you know, just everything is downward pulling. And even in our more mature way of relating, it's like, oh, this just happened, or, oh, it's just been such a day, like that. Now, the science of yoga explains it in a very simple way, that what happens first is the energy in the spine. The energy is being drawn down to concentrate in the lower chakras because the lower chakras are more ego-based. They're more dependent. They represent, I mean, this is not a class on the chakras, but the energy going lower in the spine represents a relationship more with the heaviness of the earth. The energy rising the heart and above represents a more aspiring energy. And whenever we allow our consciousness to react to anything, we are creating magnetism somewhere along this alignment. And the lower it is, the more we sink. The more elevated it is, the more we rise. And the actual first thing that happens is the energy responds, and that causes us to have this experience. Now, the entire practice of yoga, especially Kriya Yoga, and the breath is very closely related to this upward and downward flow of energy. That's why so much beginning meditation is about watching the breath, isn't it? Final meditation is just about watching the breath. And people come into a meditation class, our first meditation class, and maybe they've been waiting years to start meditation classes, and they've researched, and they finally get to our class. And we say, okay, close your eyes and watch the breath. In, out, in, out. And it's sort of like they say something like, well, and, you know, and so then, and after that, and where's all the big complexity? Where's the big promise of all this? No, you just watch the breath. In, out, in, out. And it's very easy just to pass right over that. But the in and outflow of the breath is intimately tied to the rising and the falling of energy in the spine. And whether that energy is outwardly focused or internally focused, how deeply we are in the center of our own being, how much mastery we have over the kundalini energy, whether it's running us or we're running it. And we work so hard in this world to just get our scenes organized. In the course of all that's been going on in the last few weeks with Swami visiting our house several times and so on like that, you know, I just looked at my own personal space. It's just been disintegrating. My closet was just like my clothes. I just sort of have to kick them aside and rummage through these piles on the floor. And my desk is still just a heap of paper. Even my computer desktop is just covered with random little files. You know, it's just like we work so hard just to keep this external world into some kind of order, don't we? And how much of life is, you know, shopping for food, cooking food, fixing your house, doing your garden, taking care of your physical person, all of these different ways we're trying to keep life in order. But all of it comes always back to whatever inner state of consciousness we're experiencing. Why do we even do all of that? Because to be homeless would make us very insecure. For me to have my closet like that has just been, you know, wreaking havoc with my mind. So I spent yesterday straightening it out. You know, if we're cold and we don't have a warm jacket when winter comes, something happens to our consciousness. Isn't that so? If nothing happened to our consciousness, we wouldn't feel inclined to do that. And that's why some people can live in ways that others of us don't understand how they can live that way. When we first moved into our apartment complex, there were many people living there who lived sort of marginalized individuals. When we moved into what is now our ARP community, it was very run down, and it was kind of a refuge for people whose lives were not working so well. And many of the apartments were all done in dark browns with heavy curtains, and the people kept the curtains drawn. It was sort of like this is sort of externally expressed. And, you know, we would go into those places and think, you know, how can you live like this? Because that environment affected our consciousness in a way that we didn't like, but it was in tune with the consciousness. It was an expression of their consciousness. Now, coming back from all of this, and again, you understand it, what we're always trying to affect is how what we're experiencing. And the basic premise of yoga is a very simple one. What we're always experiencing is the direction and the flow of energy, and whether it's being dissipated in ways that will not ultimately give us the fulfillment we need, or whether it's being focused and conserved and used in an upward and a downward flow. And what is self-mastery? What is self-control? Self-control is the ability to be able to direct your response to whatever comes to you, isn't it? When someone comes to you and says something you don't like and you get very impatient with them, and then later you think, why did I respond that way? Well, I have this reason, I felt that way, and he or she didn't understand how I feel about this, and they, you know, we have all these reasons. But the real issue was, if in that first split second there had been mastery over the energy, and the energy just didn't flow out and then manifest, it comes out of the mouth because internally it's already had a response, you see? And all of yoga practice is getting conscious mastery over that energy. Because once you have conscious mastery over that, civilizations can rise and fall, you see, and it never makes any difference. It never matters to us. We live in this world on a very, very temporary basis. We're just here such a short period of time. When Swami spoke to us at the San Jose Center for the Performing Arts a couple of weeks ago, which many of you know, I mean, he just made the simple statement, you could be dead 5 minutes from now. You could just walk out of here and an accident could happen. Very tragically, you know, a young man, the son of friends of ours, he was killed in an accident just a couple of days ago. A promising young man in his 20s. Just freak accident, gone, just like that. You know, it's all about the mastery of our energy, no matter how orderly our closets are, you know. When it's time for us to exit this world, we just will. When it's time for us to feel perfect joy, we will. And we won't feel perfect joy because this whole world has gotten perfectly organized. It's because we have gradually begun to gain mastery over our inner reality. Now, this is a very, very subtle teaching. And it can be very much misunderstood. And this is why you have to have a certain degree of refinement before you'll even hear the idea that this is all that matters. This is what Swamiji was talking to us about so much over the last few weeks. And when you read Whispers from Eternity and so on, it's just so much in there that everything finally comes back to whether or not I am able to focus my mind on that level of consciousness that I choose to focus it on, or whether it's constantly being batted about by the realities around me. And yoga practice, when we finally reach a certain point, and we've done over the last year, we've done a lot of conversations of marketing and demographic studies and why do people come to Ananda and who are the people who come, and just out of a desire to serve better, out of a desire to understand the times in which we live. You know, it's not like our intention is to proselytize. That would be entirely contrary to everything we're reading today. But because our desire is to be able to communicate in such a way that those who have the receptivity will recognize in what we're saying what they are looking for. And I think there's a line in the sand, and that line in the sand is when the realization begins to dawn that what my life is about is my internal consciousness. And that even my external life, you know, my success in business, my harmony with my friends, my ability to find a mate, my ability to live successfully with that mate after I find him or her, all depends on my inner consciousness. I've over the years, especially previous to now, I used to do a great deal of counseling, and I did a great deal of couples counseling over the years, not formal marriage counseling like a psychologist would do, but pastoral counseling, just trying to help married couples come to a greater sense of harmony. I have to honestly say, very rarely, and I can't think of even specific examples, but very rarely were the difficulties between two people really caused between them. It was always caused within them. It was always based on an inability to come to a mature understanding of one's own self, and then that the dissonance that would be caused after that. Now, understand, even the scriptures say there are reasons when couples should separate. It's not just a question of no matter who I have, no matter how much it's pulling me down. As Swamiji says, it's no victory just to stick it out grimly to the end. And I myself, he said once to me, you know, maybe the karma's over, he said, but I don't think so, was his word. But you've gone as far as you can go. It was about a very difficult situation I was in. He said, you've gone as far as you can go. He said, you just have to pull back now, and as he put it, grow in other ways, and then circle back around behind it. Not necessarily even with the same people, but with the same situation. So I put that in as a caveat. But what it's all about is this practice of learning to control ourselves. A Swami I heard speak once in a most interesting way. He gave a very interesting talk at Ananda about Kriya. He was a cousin brother of ours, not exactly in this lineage. And I was really curious how he could talk to our community, which the truth is so well instructed by Swami Kriyananda, there's not a lot you can say. But he gave a very interesting talk. This is Swami Shankarananda from Rishikesh. His talk was about breathing. And it wasn't even instruction about how to breathe well. He just pointed out to us in a humorous, in a very interesting way, that whatever else happens, you're always going to be breathing. He said, no matter what, you're always going to be breathing. He said, and in fact, the single responsibility you actually have is just to keep breathing in and breathing out. And how many of us, as he put it, take that responsibility very seriously? We tend to sort of leave it in the hands of the unconscious part of ourselves, don't we? We just let it breathe all the time. But once we begin to understand the intimate relationship between the flow of energy within our spine and the relationship between our consciousness and that flow of energy, then the responsibility to breathe becomes quite central, because in our fundamental meditation class, we're showing if we're just aware of the inflow and the outflow of breath, that's the doorway that makes us aware of the rising and the falling energy in the spine, and awareness is the beginning of being able to consciously direct that. And if we can consciously keep the energy in the spine in a harmonious, continuous flow, instead of having it be, I mean, even when there's trauma, isn't it? You know, there's difficulty breathing. There's suddenly, you intake your breath, and, you know, you'll often try to calm someone down by just saying, breathe. Okay, just concentrate on your breathing. Just breathe. Isn't that so? Because when the emotions get wacky, the energy gets wacky, and the breath gets wacky, or it gets very shallow or very fast, all these things that it shouldn't be. But if we have trained ourselves, just in a most everyday practice, just to be very steady and consciously aware of that constant inflow of breath, we stare at it. Remember those children's pictures I remember reading, the funny papers, when I was a child, and one of the things I liked was this picture, and you had to find the mistakes in the picture. There would be two pictures next to each other, and then you would just stare at it, and gradually things would come out of it that you didn't notice there the first time. It wasn't that they were added to the picture. It was only that if we looked at it with greater concentration, it began to tell us something it wasn't telling us in the first place. And so it is when we're instructing beginning meditators, it may seem boring to you at first, because all you're thinking about is external things. But the more consciously and continuously we are aware of the simple fact of breath flowing up and down, the more our entire life begins to be defined by the direction and the quality of this inner flow of energy. And if we have mastery over that, there's no circumstance of our life that can take away from us our ability to be in the consciousness, the exact consciousness that we choose. Now think of the power of that. Now this I was beginning at the beginning about commenting about how the masters often say, if you're right with the guru, it doesn't matter what anyone else is saying or doing. To be right with the guru means to be in that internal flow of consciousness. And this is again the practice that Master was suggesting. You concentrate on the qualities of the saints or of your guru, whatever, however you want to think about it. And you get deeper and deeper in tune with what that inner consciousness is. And what is that consciousness within them? Their personality, their work, their physical being, All of it is just a very thin encasement for a level of consciousness inside of them. And that consciousness is the flow of energy. And the more we literally attune ourselves, Swamiji has often suggested one of the techniques for doing Kriya Yoga practice better or for meditating better is imagine that Master is sitting with you and that your spine is his spine. Or that you're sitting inside his body. Or sometimes Swamiji talks in it's an odd way of having Master sort of on the top of your head, like this, and then his spine is an extension of your spine. And that the actual literal flow of energy up and down through your inner self is the same energy flowing through the Guru's consciousness. I was just in my house one day and this thought came into my mind, what would it be like to be absolutely free? Oh no, by the grace of God, I feel that I'm generally a buoyant person. But Swami described it, I think in Los Angeles, he said, no matter what's going on, there's always this certain something within us, isn't there, he said, that makes us feel a little constricted and a little anxious. It was just such a poignant and simple statement. I was able to realize when he said that I've been powerfully motivated since childhood to escape from suffering, even though I've hardly ever suffered. You know, I've been very cheerful and very blessed in my life. But when he said that, I realized the suffering I have always felt is that certain something, that certain constricting something that stands in defiance of what we actually know to be our true destiny. Isn't that the way it is? And that's a very simple word for it. It's ego. It's the energy of our consciousness identified with this limited reality, and our soul chafes against that. It just chafes against it. And we will never be satisfied. We will never be free until everything within us is liberated and that consciousness of the Masters is our very own. You know, it's the spiritual path is not easy because life tries all the time to give us false answers. It works very, very hard to give us false answers. But just because it's not easy doesn't mean it's complex. It's very, very simple. And one of our fundamental teachings is to consciously breathe. And I don't just mean breathing like that, but to make that connection with our deepest reality a constant conscious experience. And by that concentration to discover that that is truly the doorway to the infinite.